So tonight we're in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32, the study of David, part 2. And we've been in this verse-by-verse study of Hebrews for a while now. And right now we're attempting to understand why this man, David, was included in the famed Hall of Faith. Hebrews 11, 32, "And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel, and the prophets." And if you need to refresh your memory on part one of David, please go back and listen to the teaching on the website. They're very connected, and so some of the things that you're going to hear tonight are connected to that, so it might be good to go back and listen or refresh yourself. So we've learned so far that David was the youngest and kind of forgotten brother who is relegated to just caring for the sheep. Pretty much lived his days outdoors, under the skies, exposed to the elements, until the day that Samuel the prophet showed up at his house and asked for him. And as David comes in, he anoints him with oil, which meant just one thing and one thing only, that David was going to be the next king of Israel. However, there's a problem. David was only a boy. We're not sure how young he was, but from the text, it seems like he was extremely young, probably somewhere between 10 and 12 years old. And the current king, Saul, was not about to give up his kingdom. See, Saul was a king that had been fashioned in the ways of kings, the ways of men. As such, he never submitted himself to the Lord's rule over his life. He was a man of his own will and his own intention, and it really did not matter to him what God said. He took it as kind of an advisory thing, but never as the word of the Lord. All that really mattered to Saul is what Saul wanted. And as a result, God said that he was going to take the kingdom from him and give it to one who is better than him. That scared Saul. In addition, the Lord sent an evil spirit to Saul that would overtake him and cause him to rage like a bloody madman. And David, meanwhile, somehow over the next couple time periods, found his way into the king's palace, where he played and sang to Saul whenever Saul was tormented by this evil spirit. And David's song seemed to be just the thing to relieve Saul's crazed mind. Eventually, David became one of Saul's favorites. Saul asked him to become his armor bearer, one of his trusted advisors, one of his generals eventually, and he was just so well thought of by Saul up until the time when the people started heralding David's many achievements. You see, having been trained in the ways of kings and the ways of men, Saul was not about to be outdone by another. He was the king, not David, and he was not going to let anyone threaten his glory. So Saul became smitten with jealousy and paranoia, and he did what pretty much any good king does who's been trained in the ways of kings, the ways of men. He turned on David, hunted him down, and tried to kill him. More than once, he tried to pin him to the wall with a spear. David just dodged the blow and fled. See, Saul was a madman, and even though David had never done anything to harm or to threaten him, he wanted David dead. And as a result, at a very young age, David had to flee the kingdom. He had to leave his family, and he found refuge in the desert with a handful of rejects and malcontents. And this was the time when God enrolled David in his school of ministry, affectionately known as Pain Central. We talked about that last time. Saul was the headmaster of this school, and suffering and sorrow were his main professors. This school, this desert, this place of exile and rejection and loneliness was going to be the place where David would learn not to walk in the ways of kings, the ways of men, but to trust that his God is so big and so gigundous that he would take care of him and be his God, even when everything in his life, from a practical perspective, just totally sucked. It blew. His life was no fun at all. You see, the world had known enough kings like Saul, and it was time for a new king, one who would be a man who would live after God's own heart. But for this to come to fruition, David had to learn about God's heart so he could learn what he was pursuing, what he was going after. Hence his enrollment in God's School of Ministry, where he would receive very hands-on, personal instruction. And as we studied, David was a promising student at the top of his class. Twice he had the opportunity to kill Saul. I mean, it was as if God just handed Saul up to him, just put him right in his hands. Just one swing of the blade, that was it. David's suffering would be over. The kingdom would be David's, just as the Lord had promised. And the people would be saved and protected from this madman, this king. It all made perfect sense. But David had listened in class. Therefore, he refused to take matters into his own hands and to stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed. David said in 1 Samuel 26:10, "Surely the Lord will strike Saul down someday, or he'll die in battle, or of old age. But the Lord forbid that I should kill the one he has anointed." David had decided that if God promised that he would be king, God would make it happen. And it was not up to David to push forward God's agenda. God never told David at what age he would become king. So David decided that God was in control of his life and that God was fully able to deal with Saul, to protect David and hand over the kingdom in his time according to the kind intention of the Lord's will. David decided that he would wait as long as was necessary for God to act on his behalf. He decided that God was his God, and he did not need to pretend that he could fulfill that role. You see, David's faith was becoming more than just a spiritual concept or ideal. It was becoming his faith. It was becoming tangible. It was becoming the anchor for his life, and he would not quickly exchange it to obtain comfort, position, acclaim, power, authority, or security in this life. It was far too valuable to him, his faith in this relationship with his God. And as David entered into his senior year in Payne Central, he found that even though it was still so uncomfortable living in the desert, always on the run, the classes were actually getting a little bit easier. He kind of knew what to expect, and it seemed that the professors backed off a bit, let him have a little breather during his senior year. And this was a welcome surprise for someone who had become used to nothing but hardship. So we're going to pick up in 1 Samuel 27, 1-4. See, David decided once again to get as far away from Saul as possible, and he fled to the Philistines, the arch enemies of Israel. And he thought that since Saul was deathly afraid of the Philistines, he would give up his hunt as long as David was with them. And it worked. Saul actually pulled back his men and just went back to being a mad king. And during this time, David took up residence in a Philistine village called Ziklag. And in effect, David acted as a judge of Israel, like the judges of old, bringing God's judgment on those who were enemies of Israel. Now, the Philistine king, Achish, he really liked David. And he allowed him to stay in Ziklag, and believing that David had truly defected from Israel and he was helping the Philistines, because David had actually told him that he was launching all these attacks on southern Judah, which is not quite what he was doing, but the king believed him. David was actually using this time to just wipe out some of the Canaanites in the land who were never completely conquered by Joshua, the prior judges, or King Saul. So David exterminated the Jeshurites, the Girzites, and the Amalekites who lived near Shur along the road to Egypt. In fact, David did not leave one person alive in the villages that he attacked. That way no one could go back and tell King Achish what he was really up to. And this happened again and again while he was living among the Philistines. Could you imagine just being in a village taking, you know, doing your daily duties, and all of a sudden these men come riding in horses, and that's it. Everybody, men, women, and children, everything completely slaughtered. And yet Achish, he totally believed David's story. He thought that the people of Israel must really hate David for what he was doing. But it was all a ruse, as David was biding his time, expanding his future kingdom. But then this time came when the Philistines decided to launch just another massive attack against Israel. They were going to throw everything at them. And King Achish actually went up to David and asked him to join him in this battle. And David said, "Very well. Now you'll see for yourself what we can do." 1 Samuel 28:2. And I believe that David was speaking the truth, but with a forked tongue. He would not lay his hands on the Lord's anointed, neither the king nor the people of Israel who were set apart by the Lord. So it's likely that David was just planning on going to war and then turning on the Philistines and showing everyone, including King Achish, how he and his 600 men could fight like no others. And interestingly, David has so convinced this Philistine king that he was a true defector that King Achish asked him to be his personal bodyguard during this battle. Meanwhile, back home, Saul's totally freaking out. The Philistines just came with this massive army, and God was not talking to him about what he should be doing. Which, if you think about it, why would he expect God to talk to him? He never listened to God's voice any of the other times that God directly spoke to him. He just blew him off. He had a lot of nerve sitting there demanding that God speak to him. And not only that, he was demanding that God speak to him in the way he wanted, either through dreams or through casting lots. It doesn't work that way. Mad kings don't get to demand from their God what they want. You see, we never see Saul going and just prostrating himself before the tabernacle, before the Ark of the Covenant, and in true repentance seeking the Lord's will. Instead, when God does not do things the way he wants, Saul becomes so frantic with fear that this mad king actually goes out and seeks a medium, or which we would know as a spiritualist or a channeler of ghosts or the so-called dead. So Saul goes, you know, he's saying, "God, answer me, answer me." God's saying nothing. So he goes and hunts down this woman. And he asks her to call up Samuel, the prophet Samuel, from the dead. After all, he's the one who used to bring the word of the Lord to Saul. So the woman, she starts doing her mystic stuff, her spiritual stuff, to start calling up the dead. And to her absolute surprise, she saw Samuel, and she totally freaked out. The Bible says that she just screamed in fear. You see, she was used to playing in the realm of the demonic, where the spirits she saw and heard were just these apparitions who were disguising themselves as the dead. And they said common things that, you know, demons kind of say, and she was used to that. But in this case, something was totally different. And we have no idea really why, but the Lord allowed Samuel to come from the dead, to come from his place in Sheol, from the bosom of Abraham, and come forth to speak to Saul. And this medium was scared to death. She says that there's one like a god who is coming from the earth. And she described him as an old man wrapped in a robe. So Saul just falls on the ground before him. And the conversation goes as follows. 1 Samuel 28:15 through 20. "Why have you disturbed me by calling me back?" Samuel asked Saul. "Because I'm in deep trouble," Saul replied. "The Philistines are at war with me, and God has left me and won't reply by prophets or dreams. So I have called for you to tell me what to do." But Samuel replied, "Why ask me, since the Lord has left you and has become your enemy? The Lord has done just as he said he would. He has torn the kingdom from you and given it to your rival David." The Lord has done this to you because you refused to carry out his fierce anger against the Amalekites. What's more, the Lord will hand you and the army of Israel over to the Philistines tomorrow, and you and your sons will be here with me. The Lord will bring down the entire army of Israel in defeat. Saul fell full length on the ground, paralyzed with fright because of Samuel's words. In one day, God would fulfill his promise to Saul and lay the groundwork for fulfilling his promise to David. You see, God always does as he promises, always. It's often so hard for us to believe this because, number one, either the passage of time from when God made that promise, or number two, the ways we tend to think about the promises that God made to us. You see, we usually have it all figured out for God in terms of how he is going to do things, when he is going to do things, what it's going to look like, and how in our mad king mindset, we believe he should fulfill things for us. But that way of thinking, thinking like kings, thinking like men, leads to massive disappointment, frustration, and doubt. Because number one, time seems to erode the faith of most men the way that water over time erodes the most impenetrable barriers. And number two, God's thoughts are not our thoughts. His ways are not our ways, Isaiah 55:8. So his plans rarely, if ever, go according to our agenda. Now, even though I've been bummed out by that, I have found that his ways are always so much better. As Romans 12:2 says, his ways are good, pleasing, and perfect. Again, his ways are good, pleasing, and perfect. You see, that is why it is so important to know the character and nature of our God. He is good. It's fundamental to his character. In fact, only God is good. Therefore, all that he allows in our life, whether we understand it or not, is an expression of his great love for us. And when we know this to be true and actually trust ourselves to the character and nature of God, we will be able to rest. We will be able to wait for him to do as he promised, because he always does. It's just a matter of time. In this case, David had waited somewhere between 10 to 15 years from when he had to flee the kingdom. Can you imagine wandering in the desert, living in caves, exiled from your own people and family, running for your life as a fugitive who did nothing wrong, just waiting and waiting and waiting for this seemingly intangible God to do what he said he would do? Days turns into weeks, weeks into months, months into years, into years, into years, and years, and years, and years. And then in one day, like that, David's mortal enemy is forever removed. One day, reality looked one way, depressing, as if things would never change. And the next, it would take on an entirely new dimension. Suddenly there would be hope that in his lifetime, he would experience all that God had promised. Suddenly everyone would know that the promises of God are not something that are just to be fulfilled in the afterlife, but also in this life, in our present reality. Sure enough, the next day, Saul and Jonathan died in battle, just as the Lord had said. David actually didn't get to fight in this battle, as the Philistine generals, the commanders, they did not nearly have as much trust for David as King Achish did, and so they made David and his men leave the battlefield. So while Israel was battling the Philistines, David and his men rode the 3-day journey back home, and he found that the Amalekites had done some serious damage to their hometown. It's an amazing story. So they left for Ziklag. They were originally in Ziklag. They left it to join the Philistines on these front lines. And while they were gone, okay, doing their business, the Amalekites came and made a raid on multiple towns within Judah and Philistia, and they attacked Ziklag. They burned it to the ground, and they took everybody and everything away. Women, children, animals, all their possessions, and yet they didn't kill anyone. And when David and his men returned, David wasn't expecting this. His men were furious at him. They didn't take their anger out on anybody else. They were mad at David. He was their leader. Remember, they were never too keen about David not having ended this whole fiasco back in the cave when Saul was in his hands. And now their wives, their children, their possessions, they were all taken. We're told that they were so enraged, these men that had followed David for 10 to 15 years, that they wanted to stone him. And it's so interesting what happened, because right about now, any normal soon-to-be king who was trained in the ways of kings, the ways of men, would start to have second-guessed their decision to trust God. After all, what good did it do? God had once again let them down. All that he loved was taken by the enemy. And at this time, David had no idea if they were laying dead in some field somewhere, if they took him and just slaughtered him. He had no idea. His home was burned down. And now his men, the ones he had cared for all these years, turned on him and wanted him dead. Everybody wanted David dead. You could almost picture David saying, "Hello, God, are you watching? Are you listening? I trusted myself to you. I did what you wanted. And then you let this happen? Why? Why?" But that is how soon-to-be kings who have been trained in the ways of kings, the ways of men, think. But that is not how it is with those who know their God and who are soon to be graduates from Payne Central. David's first response in tragedy was to turn to the Lord, not to turn away from the Lord, as many of us tend to do. David calls for Abiathar, the priest, and has them bring the ephod so he could inquire of the Lord. And David doesn't ask why. David doesn't complain. He doesn't ask for protection from his men. He simply asks, "Should I chase them? Will I catch them?" Think about it. This is amazing. See, David is so convinced still, no matter what's going on around him, that the Lord is entirely in control of his life. He made a promise to David. David knew his men couldn't do anything to him. He wouldn't die. God was going to fulfill this promise. He was walking kind of as an immortal during this time. He knew it. He believed what God told him, even though his men were totally freaking out. And so when everything is in chaos, he's able to think about his people, focus on their needs and not on his own self, not on that whining and that just inward sense of, "Why me?" He's just concerned for, "Can I go rescue them?" And the Lord told David, "Yes, go after them. You will surely recover everything that was taken from you." 1 Samuel 30, verse 8. So David and his 600 men head out after the Amalekites. But on their way, 200 of his men were just too exhausted to go any further. As their journey, you know, they had journeyed 3 days out to the front lines, hung out there, 3 days back. They were exhausted. So David left him by a river, and he proceeded with only 400. And then when they caught up with the Amalekites, they found them like dancing and partying, enjoying the plunder they had taken. And David and his men just rushed in among them and just slaughtered them. It says throughout the night, the entire next day, up until evening. I mean, this was a totally supernatural act. I mean, they were exhausted, yet they fought for probably 20 hours straight, swinging swords, punching, kicking, stabbing. And they killed everyone, except for 400 young men who fled away on camels. And they retrieved everything the Amalekites had taken. Nothing was missing, small or great, son or daughter, nor anything else that had been taken. David brought everything back. 1 Samuel chapter 30, verses 18 through 19. Now David knew that this amazing victory was totally the Lord. He asked the Lord, would he win? He went and won, and he remembered it was the Lord. It wasn't him. And we see this displayed in his attitude towards the 200 who had stayed behind. See, David's men had gathered up all the flocks and all the herds and all the possessions that belonged to the Amalekites and brought them back as a reward. But some of the 400, some of the malcontents, said that the 200 can't have any of the plunder since they didn't fight. But look at David's heart. 1 Samuel chapter 30, verse 23 through 25. No, my brothers, don't be selfish with what the Lord has given us. He has kept us safe and helped us defeat the band of raiders that attacked us. Who will listen when you talk like this? We share and share alike, those who go to battle and those who guard the equipment. From then on, David made this a decree and a regulation for Israel, and it is still followed today. It's probably a little bit about what Paul was thinking about when he wrote 1 Corinthians, talking about the body and how every piece is as important as the other. The pinky, the little toe, and other unmentionables are just as important as the eyes, the mouth, the hands, and the arms, or the legs. Everybody has a role. Now, unlike Saul, who we found out was always off making some memorial to himself so he could be honored by others when they had victories, David was interested only in honoring others. This soon-to-be king knew that everything about his life, everything that he had, was a gift from God. And he wanted others to live in this manner. If God brought the victory, then no one had the right to act as if they had done it. For without the Lord, they just might all be dead. And this was another important lesson that we'll get back to because it's going to prove to serve David later on in his life. So back in Israel, the Philistines routed the Israel forces. Saul, three of his sons, including Jonathan, and his armor bearer were all killed. When David heard the report, he and his men tore their clothes in sorrow. They mourned and wept and fasted all day because so many had died that day. 2 Samuel 1, 11 through 12. And I find this fascinating. We don't read that anyone was rejoicing over Saul's death. You would think that after what David's men had been through, they would have been saying things like, yes, finally that no good son of a Benjamite is dead and we can move back home. No, they mourned. This tells me that as a leader, David was able to influence the hearts and minds of his people. He turned their hearts from hate to hearts that actually cared, that had emotional connection to what took place. Remember, these were the malcontents. They had been kicked out. They were not accepted in Saul's kingdom. They were not accepted by their people. They owed money. They owed taxes. They had done crimes. These were bad people. And now their hearts, after spending time with David and the presence of David and his love for the Lord, their hearts had melted. And he led these people not just to obey him, but to actually share his values, share his concerns, share his heart. And then David writes, it's an amazing song that totally praises his enemy. In it he sings in 2 Samuel 1, 22 through 25. The bow of Jonathan was powerful, and the sword of Saul did its mighty work. They shed the blood of their enemies and pierced the bodies of mighty heroes. How beloved and gracious were Saul and Jonathan. They were together in life and in death. They were swifter than eagles, stronger than lions. O women of Israel, weep for Saul. For he dressed you in luxurious scarlet clothing, in garments decorated with gold. Oh, how the mighty heroes have fallen in battle. See, you have to understand, when a king dies, it's a very crucial time. You have a short window. And those who are strategic are thinking, okay, we need to get the people to follow David as quickly as possible. So David, you would think, would have been out there saying, hey, I want you to understand this. This was all unnecessary. None of this would have happened if it wasn't for Saul's pride and his insanity. All your dead brothers, dead fathers, unnecessary. If we would have been there, me and my men, we would have just routed the Philistines like we did the Amalekites. But David did no such thing. He didn't use that little window to his own advantage. David, again, didn't live as most soon-to-be kings. Rather, he trusted this whole king thing to the Lord. He wanted the people to honor Saul, even though he had spent the last 10 to 15 years running from Saul. And surprisingly, the 600 malcontents did the same thing. Maybe it was this story that Jesus had running in the back of his mind when he said, "But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous." Matthew 5, 44 through 45. So soon after this, Judah's leaders came and crowned David as their king. And so David sent a message to the rest of the people of Israel and asked them to come be his loyal subjects now that Saul was dead. Well, to David's surprise, this didn't happen. The commander of Israel's army took Saul's son, Ishbosheth, and crowned him king over Israel. In fact, it would be another 7.5 years before Israel would accept David as their king. Again, let's stop and get into the mind of a normal man who would likely be so bummed out thinking, wait a minute, you said king of Israel, not king of Judah. They don't want me. They chose their own king. How come it seems that everything with you has a catch? And everything with you is never as is represented. Why is there always more waiting? Have I not waited long enough? I thought I graduated. I never wanted to be in your dumb school of ministry in the first place. But then to have you take me on the brink of the promise, I'm like looking over the edge. I see it right in front of me. And to have it just all fizzle away? I mean, that's cruel. I don't get it. I don't understand. That's how we would think. But David doesn't think like a normal man. Remember, he did not learn to walk in the ways of men or in the ways of kings. David learned that there is no safer place to be than smack dab, center, in the middle of the Lord's will for his life. And so he settled into his kingship over Judah. And over time, Judah became stronger and stronger, and Israel became weaker and weaker, until finally, after a lot of intrigue and mishaps and murders, David was innocent, but others did all this stuff. Finally, David was anointed king over all the tribes of Israel. They told him in 2 Samuel chapter 5, 1 through 3, "We are your own flesh and blood. In the past, when Saul was our king, you were the one who really led the forces of Israel. And the Lord told you, 'You will be the shepherd of my people. You will be Israel's leader.' So there at Hebron, King David made a covenant before the Lord with all the elders of Israel, and they anointed him king of Israel." Finally, it happened just as the Lord said. Now, David was only 30 years old when he became king of Judah, and 37 years old when he became king of Israel. So that kind of puts things into some context. He's not some old dude, some old king. And it amazes me that most of his time enrolled at Payne Central, he was in his 20s. And yet, this young man showed an amazing amount of wisdom and understanding when it came to the ways of the Lord. So why do you think David had such wisdom at such a young age? It's a rare thing. You really don't see it that often for someone in their early 20s. So I would like us to go back to a time where we don't have a lot of direct information, but we do have a lot of indirect information. And that is when David was just a boy out in the fields watching the sheep. Psalm 78, 70 through 72. He chose his servant David, calling him from the sheep pens. He took David from tending the ewes and the lambs and made him the shepherd of Jacob's descendants, God's own people, Israel. He cared for them with a true heart and led them with skillful hands. So first of all, you have to understand, the life of a shepherd boy was very lonely. Very lonely job. You spent hours on end, days on end by yourself outside in the middle of nowhere. So a smart kid like David, well, he had a lot of time to think, evaluate his life, evaluate the deep things about God, to study his scriptures and so on. And somewhere as a young man along the road, it all clicked. And he realized that in the exact same way that he cared for these sheep, the Lord cared for him. Maybe David recalled the old writings, the stories that were passed down to him from his father, where Joseph, back in Egypt, first called the Lord his shepherd, Genesis 48, 15. Or where Jacob called God the shepherd, the stone of Israel, Genesis 49, 24. Or maybe he had heard one of the songs of Asaph when Asaph was a young boy scribing out songs. That young man who coined such beautiful stanzas as in Psalm 81. Oh, give ear. That's 80, verse 1. Oh, give ear, shepherd of Israel. You who lead Joseph like a flock. You who are enthroned above the cherubim, shine forth. And in Psalm 79, 13. Then we, your people, the sheep of your pasture, will thank you forever and ever, praising your greatness from generation to generation. So we're not sure when it clicked, but David definitely made the connection. He considered all that he did, all that he had to put up with when it came to his job, and he realized that in the eyes of his God, he was really no different than the sheep. First of all, David had to learn each sheep by name. And he had to know which ones belonged to him. For often shepherds would wind up in the same field and all the sheep would be mingled together. But since he knew his sheep and they knew his voice, he was able to sift through the flock and with his rod mark each as his own. And with his rod direct them or separate them so they would follow his lead. And in the same way, David knew that he was known by his God. He knew that he had been marked. He had been separated from all others. And he knew that the Lord would speak to him and he would follow only his voice. He knew that he had passed under the Lord's rod of election. He knew that he was put later on into his school of ministry. He was elected throughout his entire life. He was special, unique, set apart, belonging to the great shepherd. And that's why in Psalm 23, verse 5, he says, "You have anointed my head with oil. You have elected me, selected me from all others." Number two, the sheep were totally dependent upon David to lead them, to feed them, and to keep them safe. See, for the most part, sheep were pretty clueless about what David was up to and why. And for the most part, they were okay with it. They really didn't care. They didn't stop and demand that David reveal the plans, where they were going, what route they were going to take before they would move forward. No. They just followed. They trusted that David would do his job, that he was a good shepherd, and that he would lead them eventually to cool streams and water, or to these green pastures that had luscious, sweet grass. And sometimes they had to go through dry land that was totally barren, no water, no green grass, before they could arrive at their desired haven. Sometimes the path that David chose was a path of great risk and danger. Sometimes there was no other option and no other way to get to the green goodness. In addition, these sheep were prone to stray. And they kind of tended to just wander from here or there, thinking, well, maybe I can see some green grass over there, see a little mirage of water, they'd head over there. So David would use his shepherd's staff to gently correct his sheep, keep them going in the direction that he needed them to go, the direction in which they would be most safe. Sometimes he would hook them by the neck and just pull them back in line. Other times he would just strike them gently to get their attention. Still at other times, if a sheep really refused to pay attention, he would use his rod to just break the sheep's legs. Sometimes he would use his rod to just restrain the sheep to ensure that they didn't go into danger. And I believe that David fully understood that the Lord had to lead David through dry deserts, spiritually, emotionally, and practically, to get him to the place where he would be able to dwell in safety and peace and not live like a mad king. He didn't really like the path that the Lord had chose for him, not at all. Still, he trusted that his shepherd knew what he was doing. And so David was willing to follow. And that's why he wrote in Psalm 23:3, "He guides me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake." See, David knew that the shepherd's good character was at risk here. And if he let the sheep go into harm, then it's his name that was going to be slandered. So he could relax, knowing that his shepherd was big, his name was great, and he would always protect it. And David also knew that just because it seemed like there is no provision, it did not mean there is no provision. For no matter how bad things seemed, the Lord always led David to a place of refuge and safety. And that's why David wrote in Psalm 23:1, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." And in Psalm 23:5, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. My cup overflows." The Lord was David's provision, and he always satisfied in the same way that David was his sheep's provision, and he always satisfied. In addition, David knew that the Lord had often hooked him and just pulled him back, that the Lord had used his rod and staff to restrain his actions. And with his rod and staff, he kept David from doing things that he would ultimately regret. For example, God did not let David go to war with the Philistines. He let David, go to these places where he would find safety and refuge just in the nick of time. For example, he led David to the house of the priest where he could eat the bread, where he found Goliath's sword. And he directed David to King Achish's house where David would be protected from Saul. And that's why he wrote in Psalm 23:2, "He makes me lie down in green pastures and he leads me beside still waters." You see, the sheep were dependent upon David to keep them safe from wild dogs, bears, lions, and other predators. It's been known that two wild dogs, it's been recorded, has killed up to like 290 sheep in one night. Just mad killing frenzy. Dogs do that. And this is why David became so good at the sling. And he used to keep it handy so he could keep back any animals that were even thinking about going for his lambs. And as we studied in part one, if a bear or a lion took a lamb, David would just chase it down, grab the bear or lion by the beard, pull the lamb from his mouth, and then just beat the predator with his rod. In Psalm 23:4, David pulled from his own experiences and said, "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and staff, they comfort me." You see, just knowing that his great shepherd was with him and was well armed gave David great comfort. And he knew that he would always be safe. And that's why David, even as a young boy, was so confident when it came to his encounters with Goliath, with Saul, with the Philistines, the Amalekites, and all these other guys that he took out. He knew that his God was armed, watchful, and ready to leap into action on David's behalf. And he knew that the Lord would always deliver him. Thus, he didn't have to take matters into his own hands. He could wait on the Lord. The sheep were dependent upon David to care for their injuries, their hurts. If a sheep was cut by some rocks or a branch or some animal, or were being attacked by annoying insects, David would gently pour oil onto the wounds just to soothe them, and then he would wrap them. And then he would stay close to the injured sheep and keep a special eye on it until it was fully recovered. And he spent time with the sheep. He was sensitive to their needs. He knew when they were healthy enough to drive them on, or when he had to slow down so that the young, weaker, injured sheep would not be left behind. In the same way, David was hurt time after time by so many people. He was annoyed by so many insects like dog and the other spies who told Saul where he was. But the Lord always kept an eye on David, always ensured that David escaped. He cared for David. He comforted him. And he just spoke to his soul. And when you go back and read the Psalms, you'll realize how much God spoke to this young man. Which is why he could say in Psalm 23:3, "He restores my soul." And in Psalm 23:5, "You have anointed my head with oil." In other words, you've soothed my wounds. And the Lord provided a constant outpouring of the Spirit over David. The Spirit who not only sealed him as the future king, but daily protected him from those gnats and those insects and others who would try to wound him and drive him nuts. Now, we talked about David's rod of correction. He often had to use his rod and his staff to discipline and correct his sheep. Sometimes, I'm sure from an outsider's perspective, it seemed as if David was being harsh or cruel. If we were watching it, we'd be very uncomfortable. But he knew exactly what each sheep needed because he knew them so well. He knew the ones that would respond with just a word, with just a touch, or with a crook to bring them back in line. And he knew those that he would have to break their legs with his rod. You see, if a lamb was prone to wander again and again, and in so doing put the rest of the flock at risk because the shepherd always was distracted trying to control this one, the shepherd would use his rod to break one leg of that lamb. And then he would literally carry that lamb on his shoulders until that leg was healed. And during this time, that lamb would emotionally, psychologically, and even spiritually, if that's possible, be connected to the shepherd, and it would never, ever, 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 ever again stray from his presence. And I believe that David realized that Pain Central was necessary, as the Lord had to literally break David's leg to effectively deal with his pride and his sin nature. Sure, to us as outsiders, it looked cruel. It looked excessive. It looked wanton. But the Lord knows the hearts of men and was actually being extremely merciful to David to root out from him all that would have corrupted him, corrupted his kingdom, and corrupted his future. See, the Lord had big plans for David. And he wanted to ensure that David would not be a king in the likes of Saul, a king in the likes of men, but would instead be a king after the Lord's own heart, a king who would never leave or stray from his shepherd. You see, David's kingdom ended up being glorious. And as we're going to find out next week, it was a type of Jesus's kingdom, his coming kingdom. So it's a big deal. You know, God in types. He protects those pretty carefully. We've studied that through this whole book of Hebrews. So David had to be prepared to handle such a great responsibility. Therefore, I believe that despite the pain and difficulty, the sorrow, the suffering, the rejection, the hurt, the turmoil, the hate, the accusations, David understood that if he was first broken, that goodness and blessing awaited him when God would fulfill his promises. And that's why David wrote in Psalm 23:6, "Surely goodness and loving kindness will follow me all the days of my life. And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." See, what an amazing man whose faith was forged in Pain Central. This man who learned about his God from caring for his sheep. He knew that if he was a good shepherd, that his God must be even greater than that. And he realized that every aspect of his suffering was purposeful and was intended to teach him why he can trust himself to the Lord and practically how to trust himself to the Lord. And not a single aspect of his suffering was excessive, reckless, or wanton, but all of it was perfect. I know that as I look at my time in Pain Central, I also finally understand how it is all purposeful and completely necessary for God to accomplish what he desires to accomplish, not just in me and for me, but for you and for others. And I've hated it for sure, but I am also so glad that he chose to enroll me in his special school of ministry. And I'm glad that he forcefully restrained me from ever dropping out. Now, I know that many of you do not understand all that God has allowed in your life. To you, it seems like it was excessive, reckless, and absolutely wanton, just random, without thought. Especially all those cruel, mean, distorted, twisted things that happened to you as children. And I know that's how you feel, and it's understandable. But here's the thing. You do not know what God has planned for you. You don't know how God intends on using you in the lives of others. You simply don't know. You're not a graduate yet. You don't know what glory awaits you in this life and in the life to come. And if you could understand God's desires and plans for you, I know that like David, you would be singing the Lord's praises. For you would understand that he has been more merciful to you by taking you through what he took you through. You see, he knows that only in breaking your pride and your old sinful nature will you be able to truly know him, experience him, and like David, fully enjoy him. God wants you to enjoy him. He wants to be your God and you be his people. And I want you to meditate on this truth. God has made some of you, like me, some very specific promises that he fully intends on fulfilling. But he just needs to make you ready to receive all that goodness that he has for you. And I want you to know that he has been preparing you to receive that goodness from the day that you were first brought into this life. As we studied in Ephesians 1:4, he has always known you. And even before the foundations of the earth were made, he chose you to be holy and blameless in him. And according to Ephesians 1:11, he's worked all things out, all things, according to the kind intention of his will, according to his good purposes. So every part of your life has been a preparation. Every part has been necessary. And that is why David understood this. And in Psalm, that was the slide I was looking for. Sorry, it got messed up. But that's why David understood this. And in Psalm 139:16 said, "You saw me before I was born. Every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before a single day had passed." You see, it's all been planned. It's all been necessary. Soon you will understand, I'm sure of it. I know your pain and your agony right now is so raw in many of you. It's so difficult. But when it completes its purpose in your life, that very pain and that agony will be turned into praises. It will be turned into raw worship. And like David, we'll see next week, he danced before the Lord. He wasn't ashamed. He didn't care who was next to him. He didn't care if he was on key. He was just singing and praising. And God will do that in your life when the work is completed. So next week, we will pick up with King David. Let's pray. Father, I thank you that every part of our lives has been in your hands. You've watched us from the beginning. You formed us in your thoughts even before any of us were around. And I thank you for that, Jesus. I thank you, God, that you are such a great, amazing God who is our shepherd that is so big, so massive, so great, we can't even comprehend how big you are. We can't even comprehend how active you've been and all the things that you have done to lead us, to guide us, to care for us, to provide for us, to restrain us from ourselves. And God, help us all this week, wake up, meditate on this, make some sense out of our pain central. Make some sense out of all the agony and terror that we have in our souls. And I pray that we would start to look at all that fear that we have had because we have felt like we couldn't trust you and let go of it. And instead, fully realize that we can trust you. It was all necessary, all purposeful, all part of your plan. Help us, God, surrender to you. And we ask that in Jesus' name. Amen.